Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
It is 6:14 now, and I got some rain in the area. Then they're telling me it's going to clear up, but it might rain again. But then tomorrow they're saying it's going to be clear and hot, but it might rain. You know what? I think at this time of year, honestly, without tropical weather, barring tropical weather, I think it is exactly like Matthew McConaughey in that movie Wolf of Wall Street, where he say it's a wazzy, it's a woozy, fugazi, fugazi. They don't know. Nobody knows. And I think it's the same thing here, where in the summertime, there's a chance for showers. If it's raining hard, they say, oh, look, there's a cell of showers, and it could produce heavy rainfall. If it's not raining, they're saying, oh, well, it might rain later on, because that's just the way it is in summertime here. And I don't know that anything's really changed. So if it's not raining now, the only thing I can tell you is that it might rain later on. And if it doesn't rain later on, then it will after that. And that's going to be that way through October, barring any tropical weather. So I'm glad I got that's solved. David Schultz joins us now, professor of political science at Hamline University, to talk about the spending bill. How you doing, David?
I am doing well, and I hope you're doing well, too.
I am. I see this here. I'm reading from a story here. Fox News poll found that 38% of registered voters support the One Big Beautiful Bill. And when I see 38%, I got to tell you, it goes to that's the magic number when it comes to Trump's support of his base, where it's 38%. Again, think that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't matter. Am I wrong? And am I making a false connection there or not?
No, I think you're pretty close in terms of it, in terms of he's got a core base of support that's with him no matter what, whether it's the big, beautiful bill or, you know, what just happened, you know, the bombing in Iran, whatever it may be, they are core with him. But what becomes interesting also, and again, there's different polls that have looked at different things, of course, or slightly different things. If you actually start to break it down now into terms of saying, you know, what do people like or dislike about it? You know, once you start to say things like, well, do you support the idea that, you know, that this bill may, you know, raise, you know, cut taxes for, you know, for billionaires or cut insurance, you know, for you or something like that, then it becomes a little bit more interesting in terms of where it plays out for Trump supporters. But just the generic, do you support this bill? Yep, support it. I'm with him no matter what. I trust him no matter what.
But that's what I think the disconnect is in that 38%, because they do trust President Trump no matter what. However, when you ask them, how do you feel about debt and deficit? How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? They're conflicted because they don't necessarily trust him when it comes to that, but they do trust him. So it's cognitive dissonance. So let's just support the president pretty much. Am I wrong there?
I think it is at this point. I gave a talk recently. There was somebody who, you know, some reporter asked two of us, once, both political scientists, and they say, you know, why the loyalty to Trump? And this other person said, oh, it's polarization. I said, no, it's not polarization. I said, it's really a cult of personality mm-hmm. that he's really has at this point. Is that it's just about him in terms of this attraction he has. And by the way, I'm not saying good or for bad.
No, and look, I'm getting ready to say that right now. This is not saying it's good, not saying it's bad. I'm just asking for historical context when it comes to cult of personality. Have we seen this before in this country or not?
Yeah, I think we have at some point. I think over time we've had people so devoted to who the president of the United States is, whether it's Ronald Reagan. I'm going to say it a decent past. For a while you might have had it with people such as Franklin Roosevelt, you know, that people were just very, very devoted, you know, to that person and just absolutely loved that person. Now, it's hard to figure out at this point, if you look at 250 years, is there more of a personal devotion, uncritical devotion to Trump than previous presidents? Hard to measure or hard to tell, because 250 years of a lot of history. We don't have polling that goes back. But I would suggest, though, that this is a pretty strong cult of personality, because Trump himself, I mean, he called it right on the head a decade ago, you know, with the Fifth Avenue shooting argument or line at this point. So he knows that he's got this very devoted group of people, and you give him credit for it. You know, he knows how to work with that base to be able to move things.
And, of course, no matter what you say, somebody texted in and said, Tommy has pictures of Trump on his nightstand, hashtag obsessed. Whoever texted us in, I could list about 35 things that I have on my list that take precedent over Donald Trump in terms of me caring about. At least 30 things. So believe what you want, but I honestly, I'm just trying to cover what's going on here. Let's talk about the big, beautiful bill, because what I find interesting about this is that the president has got about a year left till the midterms, right? We'll talk about this when we come back. Time till the midterms and what kind of stranglehold he's got, not necessarily a bad thing, what kind of strength he's got over Republican leaders and opposition as far as this big, beautiful bill, because it seems as though if a certain amount of Republicans, I'm just talking about the politics here, y'all, take a breath, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but in terms of the politics of it, I think if some Republicans are willing to stand up to him, then it might, in a way, be an emperor's not wearing any clothes kind of thing, where all of a sudden, it's okay, you got your 38%, but that's all you got. And then let's see what happens from here, or maybe not. I don't know. We're talking to David Schultz, professor of political science at Hamline University, about the big, beautiful bill. We'll also talk about the timeline of July 4th, what that means. 620, traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Somebody texted in, and why do you have to apologize every time you say something positive about Trump? The same reason I have to apologize every time I say something negative about Trump, because as our guest David Schultz just told you, professor of political science at Hamline University, is a very polarizing figure. It's a cult of personality, and people hear what they want. So no matter whatever you say when you mention his name, say people get butthurt, some people get happy. So I don't know what to tell you about that. Let's talk about the Republican support, because I'm just looking at the politics of this, and it seems as though if Republicans can muster the, in the Senate, can muster the strength to stand against Trump on this, this could be an emperor's new clothes kind of moment where, okay, then maybe Republicans can chart their own way for the party and don't have to fall into the cult of Donald Trump. But maybe I'm reading too much into this. What do you think?
Well, this is going to be interesting because we know we have the midterm elections next year. And for both House and Senate members, there are a certain percentage of them who are vulnerable. You know, if you look at their districts, you know, if they were to vote for the big, beautiful bill, and several senators, like what Josh Hawley has pointed this out, like if they were to make significant cuts, you know, to Medicaid, for example, this is going to hurt their constituents. And we know this across the country also. And a lot of the Republican senators are looking at it saying that, listen, for two reasons. One, I don't want to hurt my constituents. You know, my job is to help my constituents, not to hurt them. And B, if I hurt my constituents, this may endanger both my reelection or Republican control, you know, of the House and or Senate. And so it's an interesting poll at this point. Do you remain loyal to your party's president? Or do you now say, gosh, I need to act in the best interest of my constituents? And that's what's going to be really fascinating to look at here also, too, is this dual poll. And, you know, dual poll, you know, between, you know, what a lot of these representatives and senators are going to do. And it really will tell us something about the future of the party in terms of where it's headed, because at some point there will be a Republican Party beyond Donald Trump. And I think the Republicans need to figure out what that party's going to look like and what it's going to stand for.
So could you make a case, I'm trying to think what the Congressional Budget Office has said about this bill, that President Trump is saying, you know what, I'm concerned about the future of the nation, not the states and debt and deficit. And the GOP senators are saying, I'm concerned about getting reelected or about my people, so therefore I don't want to cut Medicaid, or pardon me, are both disingenuous because it's still contributing to debt and deficit?
Well, I'll go to your last statement first. If we look at, I think the most interesting warning sign that came out in the last few weeks is when Moody's basically said, we're downgrading the bond rating of the United States because of the spending that we have. And if the big, beautiful bill passes, I mean, this is going to have huge implications in terms of the debt load for the United States. And so think about this on the one level. We've got lots of Republicans and lots of us just in general who are concerned about the scope of our national debt, who are concerned about our deficit every year. And across the board, everybody recognizes the fact that the big, beautiful bill is going to have huge implications in terms of increasing our national debt, which I don't think, and I'll defer to economists. Economists are saying that's not good for the country in terms of it. So where do we go? Do we go in terms, if I'm a Republican senator, for loyalty to the president, or do I say that my first loyalty is to the good of the nation, and this bill does not further the good of the nation in terms of the debt load and the deficit?
So the Republicans that oppose it are saying you're hurting my constituents and not really doing anything to address debt and deficit. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly what we're hearing from some of them at this point. And the question now becomes, do they say at this point that those are more important concerns than supporting the president of the United States? And keep in mind, our founding fathers, you know, the Ben Franklins et al. Of the world presuppose that our system operates when members of Congress do their job. That's the whole concept of separation of powers and checks and balances. And their argument was country is supposed to come first, not loyalty to the president. In fact, your job is to check the president of the United States.
Along those lines, I just want to ask you real quick. They're going to kill me for doing this because we're late, but I only got 30 seconds. The legal mandate, whatever is needed for the president to bomb Iran, can he do that as commander-in-chief, or does he need somebody's approval for that?
He should have had permission from Congress to do that. Either the Constitution does not allow him to do this kind of preemptive attack, and the War Powers Act doesn't allow him to do that. He needed to get permission.
All right, thank you. 6:30, time for WWL First News. So that we go to Dave Cohen. 6:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Chance for showers today, then it's going to stop, then it's going to rain, then it's going to stop, just like it does every day in the summertime. Somebody texted in, so the last five presidents have bombed adversaries without authorization, but now it's a problem because Trump did it. I wish these so-called experts would make up their minds. I don't know, but I'll tell you what. In the next hour, we're going to talk to Javed Ali, a former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration, and an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. So we'll get his take on that. Right now, we're talking about Iran and oil and gas with Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. How you doing, Greg?
Doing well. Good morning, Tommy.
So I'm thinking Iran, Middle East, oil, gas problems. Am I wrong?
Oh, man. No, you're not wrong at all. It's been a tough 2 weeks. And, of course, the humanitarian crisis of what is going on is, you know, you never want to forget about when thinking about the impacts on the global markets. But yeah, it's been a wild few weeks watching what's going on. Go back in mid-June.
Greg, wait a minute. Hang a second. Put a human face on that. Talk about the humanitarian crisis, if you would. From an economist, when it comes to energy, I'm sorry, but you rang that bell and you got me thinking about it. Put a human face on it. Go ahead.
I mean, just the conflict of Israel and having the bombs, you know, going in there and thinking about the missile defense systems and just the stress to the people that are living there every day. I mean, you know, we talk often about, oh, well, this is what's happening with oil prices. How's it going to impact us at the pump? What's going to happen to the oil industry in Louisiana? And don't get me wrong, it's important for people to be informed of these things. But I think it's also important to realize that, you know, there are real people suffering with this, and we're really fortunate to be where we are.
I always get to go back to a pebble in a pond, and when you're the closest circle to that pebble hitting the pond, that's all that concerns you. As you get out from there, other things concern you, but when you're closest to that pebble, the main thing you're concerned is that the immediate ripple effect of that pebble hitting the pond, right? And that's what I think you're saying, that we got to remember a lot of people. Their lives
Absolutely.
Have been altered forever because as a result of this. Talking about the pebble in the pond and as things go out, I can remember living through the oil embargo and having to wait in line for gas when it was there, or maybe not gas as a very, very young guy with my parents. And, you know, it was a matter of whether you could get it or not. Are we beyond those days?
Yeah, I think we're definitely beyond those days, which is obviously a good thing. So I think the supply of oil globally has really been diversified. The U.S. now has seen a straight decade to a decade and a half of increased oil production, and that oil production continues to increase every year. And so kind of the relative importance of those imports from the Middle East has subsided, and in fact, we're a net exporter of oil and all these refined products now. And so the kind of days of the 1970s and the oil embargo and the conflict with OPEC, in the Middle East. I think that that's highly, highly unlikely to happen, at least in the next few years.
So I'm looking at a story here about Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz and leading to higher oil prices. We'll talk about that in a second. On the other side of it, I can also see where you can't let Iran have a nuclear weapon. What can Iran do with the Strait of Hormuz? How strategic is that? Tell me the story of the Strait of Hormuz.
Yeah, sure. So I'll back up a little bit to go back about 2 weeks. Oil prices were about $65 a barrel. And we started seeing this conflict escalating. Iran is about 5% of the global oil production, which is, of course, significant. But the Strait of Hormuz, which is right there in the Middle East, and you have all those countries ship their oil out to the world from there. So you've got the Persian Gulf. It kind of gets a little bit thin there, and that's called the Strait of Hormuz. And that's where you have, of course, Saudi Arabia. You've got Kuwait. You've got Iran, you've got Iraq, and all that oil moves through that strait. It's somewhere in the ballpark of about 20% of the global oil production is shipped through that. And so there's two things to look at. Of course, there's the production from Iran itself, but then there's also the movement of that crude all over the world. And so because of this geopolitical conflict and the uncertainty, you saw oil prices creep up from about $65 a barrel to about $75 a barrel over the course of about 2 weeks. And so Friday, I was looking at the markets at the end of the day. Again, the prices were up about $10 a barrel from a few weeks ago. But interestingly, when I was looking at the futures markets, what they were telling me is that by January or so, the price was going to be back down to about $67 per barrel. Mm-hmm. And so what this told me is that markets were really anticipating that the effect of this on the global oil market was probably going to be short-lived by a few months, and everything would be back kind of into equilibrium. Of course, then we have the further escalation this weekend. We've got the Trump administration goes in and bombs those three nuclear facilities in Iran. Monday morning comes, and I'm expecting for oil prices to be even higher, but that's actually not what happened. Mm-hmm. They ended up being relatively stable. Then we saw the further escalation right before the ceasefire, and then oil prices actually came back down to now around $67 a barrel. So interestingly, given all the uncertainty and everything that's going on, oil prices today are within about $2 of where they were before the conflict really started escalating 2 weeks ago.
And you would explain that how? Because my only comment is Jed Clampett asks, the dickens you say. How would you explain that, Greg?
Yes, I mean, the ceasefire, of course, is good news, if that is indeed is the case. But, of course, now I'm opening up the news this morning and seeing that Iran is claiming that Israel has not abided by that ceasefire. So, I think that markets are constantly trying to weigh, well, what's the risk on both the supply and the demand side, and it's the balance of those. And so as you have these conflicts arise, I think what you'll see is more volatility than in a normal kind of day-to-day.
All right, let me
and
take
so
a break.
That's what we are seeing. Mm-hmm.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We can back President on Truth Social Media saying to the Department of Energy, drill, baby, drill, and I mean now. Also saying in a separate post, everyone keep oil prices down. I'm watching. You're playing right into the hands of the enemy. Don't do it. You can explain what that means when we return. 651, 652, traffic now, WWL. 657, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, talking about Iran and what that's got to do with us and oil prices. President Trump on Truth Social posting, drill, baby, drill, and I mean now, to the Department of Energy, then saying, everyone keep oil prices down. I'm watching. You're playing right to the hands of the enemy. Don't do it. I don't know what that means. Greg, well, how did you interpret that?
Whew, yeah, that's a tough one. The individual companies are not responsible for what the price of any commodity is. Mm-hmm. And when you have a globally traded commodity, and oil's perhaps the best example of this, you literally have thousands of companies producing this commodity all over the world. You have almost an infinite amount of demand or individual sources of demand, and it's really the coming together of that for which supply and demand balance in order to have that price. And so I think it can be a politically expedient thing to say during a time where you've got prices that are fluctuating. And I think we've seen politicians on both the left and the right come out and kind of either blame the companies when the price goes up or make these kind of claims. But in reality, the companies have no real impact on what that global price is.
Well, two questions. First of all, I'm trying to figure out if oil is oil and what do we need to refine into gasoline as it relates to oil prices, and does that come from the United States or from somewhere else? If you want to answer that first.
Yeah, sure. So today in the United States, we still do import oil from other parts of the country in order to fill refineries that are specifically geared towards, not to get too technical, but a heavier and more sour crude. But we are a net exporter of oil itself because we export some of our oil directly. But we're also a net exporter of those refined products, which includes, of course, the gasoline, the diesel, the jet fuel, those kind of things that the refineries produce. And so it is an integrated global market, but we're much less susceptible to these global shocks today because of our increased production and us being a net exporter of these products.
And real quick, simple solutions, complex problems, politically expedient, I realize all that. But what's a turnaround if a company was to start drill, baby, drill, turn around on one day, okay, let's go, and then actually start producing oil and offset whatever happens with Iran? Timeline on it.
Weeks to months.
Okay. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Javed Ali, former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration. So we'll get his take on the latest in the conflict with Iran and how the Iranians are responding to the strikes, and answer any questions you have at 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker, back in a flash, WWL. It is 7:12. I don't think everything President Trump does is bad. I don't think everything President Trump does is good because he's President Trump. I think he's the president, and just like any human being, any president, he makes mistakes. He does things that are right. He does things that are wrong. However, this morning when he said that Israel and Iran, and I'm quoting here, and there's video of this, I'm not going to play it, but he says Israel and Iran don't know what the, here we go, what the, they're doing. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, because you would think a president would carry himself better than that, but then you think about maybe messages that he's trying to send to both Israel and Iran through the press, and maybe that's the exact thing that he needs to say. Javed Ali joins us now, former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration, an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. How you doing, Javed?
Tommy, how are you? Good morning.
I'm all right. I hate to start with that, but that is what your former boss said. And again, like I'm saying, I don't know what's good or what's bad. I don't know what I don't know. But maybe sometimes that does need to be said. What are your thoughts?
I just before coming on, I was catching up with the news and watched the clip. And boy, he seemed pretty angry. So as you mentioned just a couple seconds ago, he's definitely expressing his views, but I think he's sending a message as well to both the governments of Iran and Israel, because as of last night, there appeared to be some type of ceasefire. I don't think that would have been the case for President Trump to then put that out on Truth Social, but here we are now, again, in the overnight hours, and it certainly doesn't look like a ceasefire is in place because Iran and Israel are attacking each other. And that now, this conflict has been going on for 11 days. So it's so difficult to know where things stand. And we, all of us on the outside looking in just sort of have to take it on this day-by-day basis.
Yeah, we don't know what we don't know. And then it goes, I go back to Ronald Reagan with, when he thought the microphone was off and he said, we've begun attacking, whatever it was. And I'm messing up the quote here. But to this day, I don't know if he knew the microphone was on or not. And he was trying to send a message. Same thing here with President Trump. I don't know if it's a guarded moment or an unguarded moment. If it's a guarded moment, then he certainly said what he wanted to say with the intention of letting both parties know what he thought. What is the U.S.'s role? Let me take a step back here. In terms of the president taking action, you can't let Iran have nuclear facilities, correct?
Well, this has been a position that several presidents going back to the Carter-Reagan years have tried to figure out. What at least once Iran became the Islamic Republic. And actually, Iran's nuclear ambition started with the Shah and the Pahlavi regime in the early 70s. So this has been one of the thornier national security issues for the United States over those past 40 plus years. But President Trump coming back into office has said that he viewed Iran's progress towards a nuclear weapon as a red line or unacceptable. And with the beginning of Israel's campaign now going back almost 2 weeks ago, that created a window of opportunity for then the U.S. to get involved militarily with the strikes on Saturday. But the U.S. has pulled back from doing anything else since Saturday, at least up until now. So again, it's difficult to know what the White House calculus is on where the U.S.'s role is going to go forward. Will it just be that one-off set of operations on Saturday and now more on the diplomatic side, either getting some kind of ceasefire in place between Israel and Iran or the resumption of the nuclear talks between the United States and Iran? So it's just so complex with all these moving pieces. And again, every day the picture seems to change and the positions seem to shift as well.
Yeah, I get a text here I think might be interesting for you to comment on. It says, Trump bombs a country unprovoked, then 3 days later is raging that a ceasefire has been broken by two countries who have been mortal enemies for decades. First of all, did the president bomb a country unprovoked, Iran? And then is it a surprise that the countries that are mortal enemies are ignoring a ceasefire? Jump in on that, Chevette, if you would, please.
Well, looking at the decision President Trump, and he probably made that decision several days prior, once the Israeli campaign began against Iran, that moment that then led to the U.S. military operations on Saturday night that hit the three Iranian nuclear facilities, that was President Trump sort of operating under his Article 2 powers under the Constitution as Commander-in-Chief, and I said this on other interviews. Mm-hmm. I have to imagine, even before they landed on that policy decision, that White House lawyers, National Security Council lawyers said, you have the legal authority to take this kind of action because it was limited. I would think ostensibly create an argument that this was the president acting in the national or to defend the national security interests of the United States. It was not a longer campaign, so you didn't need Congress to step in and provide an authorization to use military force or a declaration of war against Iran. But that's my speculation, too. I mean, obviously not inside the administration, but I would have to think all of that legal and policy analysis was done before they approved the decision to move forward with the operation.
What was it that caused the president to decide to go ahead with this? Do you know what the catalyst was?
Well, again, we're all only speculating here from the outside looking in, but President Trump said in the run-up to Saturday night that he believed that the intelligence picture had changed, that Iran was making substantial progress towards developing a nuclear weapon, which was also Benjamin Netanyahu's theory of the case to start the military campaign from Israel, now going back almost 2 weeks. So from two Thursdays ago to last Saturday, again, what was that, almost 8-9 day period, it seemed that there was a convergence between the positions of both Israel and at least President Trump, and that was President Trump's then basis to use military force for that limited the limited operations that the U.S. conducted. But if there was going to be another round of U.S. strikes or a longer campaign, then it's going to renew the policy and legal debate about how can President Trump authorize those types of operations without Congress stepping in. So it could set up a showdown between the White House and Congress.
We have to take a break, but before I do, when it comes to the ceasefire. The ceasefire was based on, okay, we did these bombing strikes, we wiped out the nuclear facilities, let's sit still for now. Accurate or not?
Again, that seems to be the
from what
the
we
perception.
Know.
Yeah, that's what we know. But you know, inside the White House and how you know folks are thinking when they convene these National Security Council meetings, I mean, it's we're just going to have to wait and see what sort of the reporting side of this indicates.
All right, let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Javed Ali, former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration, an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. 721 traffic now, WWL. 726, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Javed Ali, former senior director for counterterrorism on the National Security Council during the first Trump administration, and an associate professor of practice at the University of Michigan's Ford School. Professor, when it comes to intelligence about Iran and nuclear weapons and the production of uranium, I read the treaty and the report, and it's very complicated stuff as far as enrichment, what can lead to what can lead to this, what can lead to that. And I just wonder about the reliability of the intelligence that we have when you consider the misplaced foray into Iraq over yellowcake uranium. Saddam Hussein did have weapons of mass destruction because he used chemical weapons against the Kurds, but he didn't have yellowcake uranium, which is why we went in, just to be clear for the people that are parsing words. Your thoughts on all of that?
Well, having come from that world in my own career in government, I was a professional intelligence officer before I spent a year at the White House. This is a very difficult.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses like Rise Bakery connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Business and intelligence analysis, as I keep saying, is an art and it is not a science. And there's no mathematical formula to help the analysts plug in all these different types of intelligence that from different sources that then give you 100% confidence, gold-plated, definitive yes-no answer. That is just not the way the intelligence business works. At best, you will get an impressionist type Van Gogh painting with a bunch of dots that looks like a picture, but a lot of times the dots are not filled in. And on the other end of the spectrum, it could look like a Jackson Pollock. And I'm not kidding when I say that. And then with all of that uncertainty on incredibly complex issues like assessing the state of Iran's nuclear program, most of it, which is probably buried deeply underground, as we saw the strikes against one of those facilities at Fordo, even if they have 75% confidence that either Iran was getting close to a weapon or the Fordo facility is obliterated, as President Trump said, there is still this other degree of uncertainty. And I'm just saying that hypothetically. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what the actual analytic judgments are. And that is the reality of what intelligence analysis looks like. It's never 100%. You're always dealing with uncertainty, and then it's up to the policymakers to make a decision based on imperfect information, and that's what makes this so hard. Sometimes it's not accurate and it's not right, and when it's not, then you have to go back to the drawing board to determine, was this an error of collection, was this an error of analysis, or a combination of the two. So again, we're not going to know right now what that intelligence picture looks like and all the different streams that have gone into painting that picture, whether it's a Jackson Pollock or Van Gogh, because it's highly classified and none of us on the outside are going to have insight into that.
I think the Jackson Pollock Van Gogh analogy is the best thing I've ever heard when it comes to national intelligence. And the only thing I would add, Javed, is that there are gatekeepers throughout, right? So you have intelligence agents on the ground that gather information, they pass along to superiors who ultimately decide what the president sees and doesn't, correct?
Well, the intelligence products that go to the president, and one of them being the presidential daily brief, or I guess that is the seminal product that goes to the president, or it's produced for the president and the senior national security leaders in the United States. That is a massive production that goes on a daily basis. So it's not like even if I were back in some of my old jobs as the mid-level analyst, or at least when I started, before I went into these senior roles, it's not like you write that at your desk and then you just send it and it goes to the president. I mean, there's layers and layers of review and editing, and before it ever gets delivered to the president or other customers. And so, again, that is just the nature of the intelligence business. It churns along every day. Most of it is behind closed doors in these highly classified environments. When it is delivered to the president, the analysts are trying to give their best call on what they think the picture looks like using those art analogies I use. But ultimately, it's up to the policymakers to decide what to do with it. That is the job of analysis, is not to make the policy recommendation. It's just to inform the policymaker, and then it's over to them to actually do something or not do something.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate your time. Quick break for news now, WWL. 7:39 is becoming a tradition, I'll tell you that. LSU wins a championship, and Bob Iback comes on from Nico Sports. Talk to us about some memorabilia. How you doing, Bob?
Hey, Tommy, nice to be with you again. And, yeah, it is a tradition, isn't it?
It is, and that's good. It's a good tradition to have with LSU winning the championships.
Oh, what a team this year. My son's with the Tampa Bay Rays. He's their assistant general manager, and he's been out there taking a look at them out in Nebraska. And he said, boy, they got about four or five guys that are going to be pretty good in the draft. And they certainly did a demolition job on the Coastal Carolina, which had won 26 straight coming in the last weekend, and of course they beat them 1-0 and 5-3 to go undefeated in the, which is very hard to do when you're out in Omaha playing in the College World Series. And we have something to celebrate for Tiger fans that I think you're going to want to get. It's very economical. It's something that will only be limited to 2025 being made. It's a fully licensed celebration baseball to celebrate the big championship win against Coastal Carolina. And like I said, only 2025 of these officially licensed baseballs that kind of commemorate the championship will be made. They're priced just $49.95 each. When you order, you'll get an individually numbered certificate of authenticity. Now, before I give out that phone number and website how you can order these, I do want to point out on various panels, side panels of each part of the baseball, will have different things that are very impressive. One of them, of course, it'll say 2025 National Champions LSU logo right there. We've got the Tiger Eye logo on one panel. We've got the Alex Box Stadium facts on another. The Tiger Head logo on another one. It'll say Season to Remember. And it sits in a really nice acrylic little case with a gold base. It really looks sharp. Again, only 2025 of these will ever be made, Tommy. And here's the two ways you can go ahead and order these. We have a toll-free number set up. Very easy, 800-345-2868. Again, that's 800-345-2868. Or just go right to the website. You can see it there, nicosports.com. It's spelled NIKCOsports.com. NIKCOsports.com. And that was their eighth national title, two in the last 3 years in Omaha. And they did, I've thought for sure it would go three games when you had to play a team that had won 26 games in a row, hadn't lost since late April coming on in. But boy, this team of Jay Johnson really did a number, and I know fans out there got to be a right to be ready to celebrate. I understand there's going to have a little celebration going on on Wednesday evening.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. As a matter of fact, we come back with Jeff Palermo, also about the chances of LSU repeating next year. So maybe, Bob, we'll be talking to you. Hopefully, I'll be talking to you after football season, then again after baseball season, let's hope. You can call 800-345-2868 or go to Nico, N-I-K-C-O, sports.com. Great piece of memorabilia. Doesn't take up a lot of room on a mantelpiece, but when they're gone, they're gone. Right, Bob?
That's right. Yeah, these are flying off. We just kicked it off yesterday, and probably already one quarter of the total is already gone. So I urge people, do this sooner than later. It'll make a great birthday gift idea or anniversary gift, or get a couple extra, you know, put them aside and put them in the stocking stuffer for Christmas.
Amen. Good idea. Thank you, Bob. We appreciate it. Again, 800-345-2868 or go to NIKCOsports.com. We'll take a break. Talk to Jeff Palermo when we come back on WWL. 947, 13 till 8. Tigers back in Baton Rouge. Big celebration plan. Jeff Palermo joins us now, WWL.com. Columnist, Louisiana Network News Director. Got a good story up at WWL.com about the chances for the Tigers next year. How you doing, Jeff?
I am doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I am okay. How can you not be? Right?
Yeah. 8 national championships, 2 in the last 3 years. If you're an LSU baseball fan, this is euphoria. This is great.
So tell me why, as a fan, I shouldn't feel as though this is like, you know, when a team wins a World Series and they break them up.
Yeah.
For whatever reason in the major leagues, what with transfer portal, name, image, and likeness, that LSU has another chance next year.
Because Jay Johnson is relentless. I think that's the best way to put it. I've made this comment several times. I don't know if I've made it on your program, but we've seen coaches at LSU when they have success, take the foot off the gas pedal. You know, John Brady, when he brought LSU men's basketball to the Final Four in 2005, certainly just took the foot off the gas pedal, and he wasn't the coach 2 years later. Paul Maneri, I think, did it in 2009. They win the national championship, and then in 2011, they don't even go to the NCAA tournament. Les Miles in 2007. That 2008 and 2009 teams were not that good. Ed Orgeron is probably the best example of it. I think sometimes when you win a national championship, you think, oh, okay, you know, these guys are just – this is easy now. Maybe easy is not the right word, but players are automatically going to come to us. We don't have to, you know, work as hard as we did to climb the mountain. And, you know, now we got the ball rolling. But, you know, when Nick Saban had a sustained success at Alabama, it wasn't by accident. It was because the guy, as soon as he won a national championship, the next day he was going after another one. And Jay Johnson has that same mindset. And when you got that kind of a mindset and you got that coaching staff and that's someone that wants to win and is not satisfied with just 2 national championships, I think that sets you up to have the potential to win several more here. And look, he's brought 2 teams to the College World Series and both of them have won. So that's a pretty good success rate. He's figured out, and not every year it's going to work. I mean, sometimes, you know, certain guys that you're counting on are not going to have good seasons, and, you know, it's going to disrupt what your plans and so forth. But this year, everything came together, and I would expect it's going to happen a time or two here again in the near future as well.
So I guess what we're talking about is complacency, and it's hard to get to it's hard enough to get to the top, even harder to stay there. And you're saying that Jay Johnson definitely has what it takes to stay there. He's relentless like a Nick Saban.
Yes, I really think that. I think he is this guy. I'm sure yesterday morning he was making some phone calls to guys in the transfer portal, some high school recruits. He was all over it. I bet this weekend he will be somewhere in this country visiting with a player, visiting with their family, maybe visiting 2 guys that he really wants. I'm sure they're going to have, and if he's not traveling, he's going to have players that are in town for a visit. I mean, he'll crank it right back up. But I would say the work to, you know, the way the roster is right now, based on the players that are returning next season, it's He doesn't have to do a complete overhaul here. He, you know, last year he had to be very aggressive because they only had 12 players left on the roster fouling the 2024 season. A lot of that was because guys were drafted in the Major League Baseball draft, and there were a few guys that had transferred out as well, and then you had guys that just, you know, graduated and so forth. But this year, he brings back a better core of players going into 2026. You know, the infield is a spot where I think you'll see the most changes, but he's got a lot of pitchers that he can got great experience this year that you expect them to be a big part of what they do next season. And in the outfield, once again, it looks like it's loaded with talented players. It'll be interesting to see, you know, there's already been some players that have entered the transfer portal, but those were guys that were on the bottom of the depth chart and really weren't figuring into the equation of either this year or next year. But there could be some guys that you're thinking might be able to contribute in 2026 that could decide to go in the transfer portal if they're concerned about playing time for next season. So that still needs to be the shakeout, but you know, LSU's received two commitments from players out of the transfer portal. I don't think you're going to see a double-digit number of players come in through the transfer portal this offseason like you did last year.
Thank you, Jeff. Great read at WWL.com. 753 traffic now, WWL.
Yes, there is, Dave, as there'll be a big celebration, 7 o'clock at Alec Box Stadium on tomorrow night as the a chance for the fans to show their appreciation to this team. You'll hear from Coach Jay Johnson. You'll probably hear from several of the team leaders. So they just did this 2 years ago, so they're getting this down, pat at this point. They're getting kind of used to this, so should be a fun night at the box tomorrow night. One more opportunity to say thanks to a real special team, a selfless team. I think that's how we'll remember this 2023 team, just how selfless they were.
All right, 8:15, typical summertime. We've had some rain early, then we might not have some rain, then we might have some more after, and it's going to be the same thing tomorrow, even though they're saying less of a chance for showers. I really do think at this time of year, the meteorologists just kind of alter it with a 30% or a 40% just to make it seem something different, but we all know what it's going to be like, but the tropics are quiet, so we'll take it. Alex Hammerstone joins us, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Here we go again. How you doing, Alex?
Not bad. How are you this morning?
16 billion passwords leaked in a massive data breach. This Yahoo story tells me that it's shocked cybersecurity researchers. Usernames, emails, passwords for Apple, Google, Facebook, and more. Data even contained credentials of government officials posing security concerns. How concerned are you?
I'm always concerned in general, right? I maintain a general baseline level of concern. But I think for this specific kind of story that's out there about the 16 billion credentials, it's a bit of a non-story. And the reason why is that, you know, as we know, there are breaches constantly happening, right? We see them on the news all the time. We get the emails about it. We get letters in the mail about it from companies we work with. And what happens is that, you know, both criminals and researchers kind of aggregate all that breach information, you know, all those lost credentials, all those lost usernames and passwords into large databases, right? And they have for years. And they use those for kind of good and evil, right? So they use them to kind of research passwords, have people create them and keep track of these things. And what this sounds like is one of those databases that kind of aggregated all the breach information over the years was exposed on the internet for a bit. Some researchers saw that, and that's kind of where this claim of 16 billion credentials came from. So, yes, they exist, and they're out there, but it's not as though there was a new data breach that suddenly released all these.
So I see a guy quoted as saying this is the mother of all data breaches, but what you're telling me is the data had already been breached, and this was from one collection site that it was stolen, so it made it like one-stop breaching?
Correct. So it's kind of an aggregation of all these breaches that are out there. And keep in mind, I mean, you know, and some may be, you know, newer, and some may contain passwords that are still in use, but some of these are probably older as well. You know, so, you know, as I said, I always kind of maintain a baseline level of concern and alarm, kind of given all the news in the cybersecurity world. But for anyone out there that's kind of listening and concerned, you know, there's a number of things we can do, right? As we talk about a lot, you know, don't reuse passwords. And by that, I mean, don't use the same password for multiple sites, right? Because then if it's breached in one site, that can affect you on other sites where you're using it. You know, use strong passwords. We always recommend passphrases, so, you know, sentences or things like that instead of those random combinations of letters and numbers. And then the really big one is
Wait, say that part again. Say that part again, Alex, what you said about random combination instead of what? With the passwords?
So a lot of times you're better off just mathematically using a string of dictionary words, as long as it's a long string or a song lyric that's hard to guess, as opposed to kind of a short string of random letters and numbers.
Let me slow down a little bit here. So when I log on to something, whatever it is, you need a password for everything. You order a freaking pizza, you need a password, which I don't quite understand, but okay, fine. So if that's the case, and sometimes it says, I guess it's Google, Chrome, whomever it is, says, you know, do you want to use this password that they suggest? And it's alphanumeric, and it's upper lowercase. They got a little bit of Cyrillic language in there as well. I don't know what it is, but I should use that or I should not use that. It would be better to put some words together like advocate, political, conflict, and cyber, for example.
So when you get a suggested password like that through one of your services, those are usually pretty great, right? Those are going to meet all the requirements. I'm referring to if you're asked to create your own password. You know, is that if you think about it, you know, kind of eight random letters and numbers and symbols versus, you know, a 30 character sentence that only you would know, and you can throw in some additional attributes like have every first word be capitalized and use at signs for A's, and those are much easier to remember and are going to end up being more secure than some of those random strings. Yeah.
As you talked
I'll
about,
also say,
go ahead.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No.
I was going to say, the other thing is with logging in to order pizza, I will say I have so many pizza points because I've got teenagers, so I get free pizza all the time. So I'm happy to log into any pizza account.
I don't understand that. Why do you have to have a password when you order pizza? What are they trying to do there? I'm not trying to sound like an old fogey. It's irritating,
right?
And it's good because it's prevented me from ordering pizza because it's like I'm not dealing with all of this.
I think everyone wants you to have an account on their site, right? Because they want to capture your data and your buying history and your information. You know, when you sign up for your, you know, pizza account, I'm sad to admit I have many of them around here. But, you know, that way they kind of know who's ordering pizza. They can send you coupons. You know, they can kind of, as I said, I earn a lot of, I have a free pizza card in my on my sun visor in my car that they stamp every time I order a pizza. So,
and sometimes when you buy clothing or whatever it is, they ask you to register to get your 15% coupon, and then you got to give them your number. And if you do that, then you get the offer. But then you also open yourself up to text messages. And I guess what I'm wondering is, in exchange for that coupon, are you then providing them with information that they sell to somebody else? And then that increases the text that you get, the spam, the whatever you get.
Most likely, you know, it really depends on the company, right? So some bigger companies won't sell your data. Others do. You know, none of us read the user agreements when we sign up for stuff. It's just a fact of the matter. You know, I work in this industry and I don't read them. I'm not going to read a 20-page user agreement.
Would you understand it?
I probably wouldn't understand it anyway.
There you go. So what's the point? I'm not trying to take up for people that don't read them. I'm just saying, if you're not going to understand it, why waste the time?
I'm right with you. And you know, and the fact of the matter is, I just think like a lot of modern consumers, I'm willing to trade my name and address and my, you know, my email address for 25% off a pair of shorts. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate, but that's kind of how it is.
But when you do that, they are using that information not just to sell you a pair of pants, but to sell to other people the information they collect, correct?
And oftentimes, yes. Not in every case, but oftentimes, yes. So, you know, there's this whole industry of data brokers that kind of just buy and sell this data and use it to market.
8:22 now. We'll take a break. We can come back. I'm going to talk to you about as it relates to the data that's out there and maybe comparing it to a document dump, if you will. And the other thing is I'm looking at this Yahoo story, and they have a picture of this hacker with a hoodie on and a mask, and it looks like something out of The Strangers. Who was the girl they were asking for in The Strangers when they knocked on the door? Do you remember? Have you ever seen the movie, Alex, or not?
I don't remember. Yeah, I forget. They've
got about 15 different versions of it, and it's always the same. Anyway, but that's not who the traditional hacker is, I don't think. We'll talk about that and more when we come back. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. Story about 16 billion passwords exposed, but they were already exposed, and they were leaked or at least hacked from one site that was already, I guess, a hacking site. I don't know. 822 traffic now, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Talking to Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. About a recent data breach, 16 billion passwords leaked in a massive data breach. However, Alex, and again, I want to make sure I'm saying the right thing. This is data that was already breached, and was that a data breach storage site that was hacked or not?
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Correct. So it looks like these are all kind of passwords and usernames that were in previous data breaches and then were aggregated into this database. So, now, there, as I said, and there are a number of these databases out there that kind of aggregate all the different information from these breaches over the years, and it looks like that's what this was.
So as you said that, the idea popped into my mind about a document dump, which for people don't know, it's like, okay, you want the documents? Here's the documents. We bury you in paper where we send trucks and trucks and boxes of paper over to you. Good luck going through it in time for the deadline. You wanted it, you got it. But at any point, does the data breach become a document dump where there is so much out there, it's hard for the people that are looking for data to find it, or is that idiotic? I don't know. It may be idiotic. You can tell me.
So I think with any electronic list, right, I mean, it takes a fraction of a second to search, right? You could search for either one of us in there, something like that. I think that when you have this much information, you probably do have a lot of, passwords that are old or usernames that are old and are no longer active. So it's with that many, there probably is a lot of information that's not really that useful to an attacker. So that certainly could be one way to look at it.
And I guess the other question is for people that are listening right now, okay, you got my data. What are you going to do with it?
So it really depends on what it is, right? And we always recommend that people use multi-factor authentication, right? And that's, the thing where you get a code texted to your phone or, even better, you're using an authenticator app on your phone or something like that, especially for your most important accounts, like your email and your banking and things like that. And what that means is that even if an attacker has your username and password, they still can't log into your account, because they're not going to know that code, right? They're not going to. So I think everyone's pretty familiar at this point with that kind of multi-factor authentication. But that's one of the most important things you can do. Anywhere that offers it, use that multi-factor authentication.
Thank you, Alex. Appreciate your time as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. We'll talk to you in a week or so when there's another massive data breach. Dane Cialino joins us as we come back, Professor of Law at Loyola. We'll talk about Louisiana's Ten Commandments Law. Where does that stand? We'll let you know right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 844, 16 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Whenever we have a question about law or legal proceedings, Dane Cialino is our go-to guy, professor of law at Loyola. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Take me back, if you will, for people that remember a little bit about it, because I think the latest thing is we're besieged by 7,200 messages a day or something like that. People that remember something about the Ten Commandments and the legislature and schools and so forth, and tell me how we got to where we are now, and then we'll talk about where we are now.
Yeah, during the 2024 session last year, the legislature passed a bill that the governor signed into law requiring public schools to post the Ten Commandments in classrooms. And then that was challenged by some plaintiffs supported by the ACLU and other organizations. The district court, federal district court in Baton Rouge, found that the law was unconstitutional because it violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, because it there is a U.S. Supreme Court case right on point from 1980 that says you can't do that. The plaintiffs, after winning, were pleased, of course, but the state appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit last week on Friday ruled that the district court got it right, that the First Amendment's Establishment Clause prohibits the public display in public schools of the Ten Commandments, and that's where we are today. We're told that the state is going to seek en banc review from the entire Fifth Circuit, and then ultimately they're going to go to the Supreme Court, who will may or may not decide the issue.
You said a lot of stuff there as a professor of law. Let me go back and rewind a little bit. You talked about Establishment Clause, and for people that are thinking, I'm just going to try to channel the audience in, or saying, you know what, we're a Christian nation. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm just saying what people are thinking and what they text in. We're a Christian nation. Why not have the Ten Commandments? And Ten Commandments, I don't think, has anything to do with being a Christian nation. But either way, thoughts on that, Dane, and the Constitution?
Yeah, well, the First Amendment says what it says, and there's longstanding case law that says that we cannot have entanglements between government and religion. And even though historically we are a Christian nation, the founders adopted the First Amendment and its establishment and free exercise clause to have some separation between church and state. And it's been debated for 250 years how much separation is appropriate. The debate still goes on today, but the Establishment Clause says what it says. And the state cannot adopt a religion or endorse a religion in a way that essentially forces it on people in public schools.
So let me ask you this, not to be an arguer or anything, but when you say history shows we were founded as a Christian nation, I don't know what that means. That means that most of the people in the country at the time were Christians, or?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly weren't, we didn't bake Christianity into the United States Constitution. In fact, quite the opposite. But
and I'm not trying to be disrespectful here. We certainly weren't a Muslim nation. We certainly weren't a Jewish nation. We certainly weren't a pick your own religion here, a Buddhist nation, right? Right.
Yeah. I mean, historically, and religion back then played a much bigger role in the day-to-day lives of citizens than it does today. But again, those are all the historical, that's the historical context. But in that context, the founders did just the opposite of what maybe some would think, which is to try to put up a wall of debatable thickness and height, a wall between church and state.
So when it comes to the different courts, take me through that slowly here, and because people try to understand the hierarchy of courts, be it state courts, district courts, federal courts, et cetera. Where was this action brought?
Yeah, this was brought in federal district court in Baton Rouge, the lowest tier of federal courts, and it was really quite an easy decision, really, for the United States district judge in that case, because this is one of these perhaps rare occasions where there is absolutely on point Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court precedent on the exact issue presented. And that was the 1980 case out of Kentucky that ruled squarely that you cannot order public schools to post the Ten Commandments. That's what that 1980 decision says. So the district court in Baton Rouge just applied the law as announced by the United States Supreme Court in 1980. Now, the reason that it was something of a horse race and perhaps remains that today is that the U.S. Supreme Court, about 3 or 4 years ago, in a case called Bremerton, Kennedy or Bremerton, whatever you'd like to call it, said that the test for a violation of the Establishment Clause is different than what it's been since the early 70s. The new test of whether a statute violates the Establishment Clause is whether or not there is a history and tradition of the practice that, even though it might have some religious nature, if there's a history and tradition that supports it, then it might pass constitutional muster. And that's the toehold that the Attorney General is trying to use to get this 1980 opinion overruled by the Supreme Court. But that can't happen until it gets to the Supreme Court, and that's where she's hoping to bring this.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Dane Cialino. The Attorney General Liz Merle is requesting an en banc review. What does that mean? We'll find out when Dane Cialino rejoins us after this break. Right now, 8:51, 9 till 9, traffic, WWL. 8:55, 5 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our friend Dane Cialino about a professor of law at Loyola about Louisiana's Ten Commandment law that was passed in 2024 that a district, help me out, Dane, I don't want to hurt myself here, a district court struck down?
A district court struck down, and the United States Fifth Circuit last week affirmed.
So the Fifth Circuit is on Camp Street, and right?
Correct.
And we all pass it, but I don't think we quite realize what it consists of. How many judges are there? Who is it that heard this Ten Commandments case, and who is it that Liz Merle would like to hear this Ten Commandments case?
Yeah, it was heard by a three-judge panel, which is typical on a federal appeal, and now she's asked for the entire court to review it. It's called en banc or in bank, which is every judge in active service of the court to hear it as a panel of the whole, essentially. I believe there are somewhere between 12 and 14 judges that are active now. I'm not sure of the exact number, but something along those lines. I was a little surprised, actually, that she asked for en banc review because she surely understands that the only court that can give her relief, the relief that she wants, which is a decision that this statute doesn't violate the First Amendment, the only court that could give her that relief is the United States Supreme Court. And the only way the United States Supreme Court can do it is by overruling its own precedent from 1980, which is something that doesn't happen terribly often. But this court has not been shy. This Roberts Court has not been shy about overruling precedent. Like, for example, we saw the overruling of Roe versus Wade in the Dobbs case. So that's why I'm surprised. I would think she would want to get this case as quickly as possible to the United States Supreme Court. She doesn't have to seek en banc review from the Fifth Circuit to do that, but nonetheless, that's what she's done.
If she does go, if she does seek that and has the en banc review, that delays it getting the Supreme Court, because surely, if the en banc review is in her, favor of her, the other side is going to appeal, or then the Supreme Court could choose not to hear it, and then it becomes law, Dane?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would be surprised if number one, she seeks en banc review, although she said that she plans to do that. And I would even be more surprised if the Fifth Circuit en banc overruled the panel decision or reversed the panel decision. I just don't think that's going to happen. Ultimately, this is going to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, which doesn't even have to take up the case. It's not an appeal to the United States Supreme Court. It's she would file a petition for certiorari, which is essentially asking the court to, in its discretion, decide to take up the case and review it, which is certainly not a foregone conclusion. There's a good chance the court would just leave this issue alone and let the Fifth Circuit panel opinion stand, which, of course, struck down the law as unconstitutional.
So when it comes to the historical argument there, if they say it is allowable under the historical context, does that open a door for other things to be included or posted in classrooms because they were intrinsic to the history of the country?
Yeah, possibly. And remember, that's the way that this law was drafted. It ostensibly, the law is trying to be make itself look consistent with the history and tradition, and having the Ten Commandments posted in the context of history was kind of an all too obvious attempt to shoehorn this law into this developing Establishment Clause jurisprudence.
I don't know if you're in the prediction business or not, but if the Roberts Court were to take this up, do you have any idea how they'd rule?
Yeah, I think it'd be a close call. I think it's more likely they're just not going to take it up and leave it alone. But I think it would be a close call. They probably would not overrule the 1980 existing case law. But again, who knows? You could guess as well as me, Tommy.
Thank you, Dane. That's right. I appreciate it. Well, two brilliant legal minds. Sure, why not? Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. We'll come back, talk to an advocate recruiter for Casa Jefferson about how much good you can do as a CASA volunteer. And we'll talk with Judy Ho. We talk about mental health all the time, about relationships between grown children, grown parents, and more. Thank you, Dave. We're going to talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, about parents and the best way to discipline your kids and relationships between grown kids and grown parents and working all of that out, because we always are concerned about mental health. But first, we're going to talk to Margaret Ether, who joins us now, an advocate recruiter for CASA Jefferson. We like to have her on every now and then because it's the best way to advocate for abused and neglected children, and we want to get all the details. Good morning, Margaret. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Is there ever a time where you don't need volunteers?
Not since I've been here, and I've been here 9 years, and it's always a need for volunteers. Yes, we need volunteers.
Tell me about the program.
CASAs are court-appointed special advocates for children that's in foster care that's been taken from their parents due to abuse and neglect and are now in foster care. We've been around a long time. CASA Jefferson is one of the bigger things in the community where we try to get volunteers to help with our children. Our children need our help. These are not my children. These are our children, and we need your help.
What kind of help do you need?
Okay, a volunteer has to be 21 years or older. You don't put children in your car. You don't bring them to your house. You don't take care of them. But so you're the eyes, ears, and voice for that child to make a difference, to let that child know what happened at home wasn't their fault. And you're there to help them to be a better person for the community, to see that your life can go in a different direction and that you are valuable to all of us. And you help make a difference. So volunteers are very essential for CASA, very essential for our community and our neighborhoods. So we need your help. As I said, you don't put children in your car. You don't bring them to your house. You don't take care of them. You don't even spend your money on CASA Jefferson children. We need you, the person, to make a difference and help with our children.
So I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
There's a class starting in July. I'm looking to put 15 people in the classroom. You're trained. You're given directions. You know your boundaries. You do have to attend court observation while you're in class. You're trained how to facilitate and help a child to understand that you're there for them.
When it comes to looking at it the other way, Margaret, if I'm a child that's in the court system, tell me what it is like for the average child, that what they're up against if they need a CASA advocate, a court-appointed special advocate from Jefferson.
Well, when a child is abused and neglected at home, a child believes it's their fault. As a volunteer, you will help their child to understand it's not your fault. Children didn't sign up for the abuse and neglect that they're experiencing at home. They're taken from their parents. They're put in the foster care system. Foster parents are there to help them to recover from what's going on. But the volunteer is that person that's dependable, that person that that child can trust, that person that's going to make that phone call, one or two phone calls per week. You have to make that home visit to make sure that your child has a decent place to sleep, getting provided, and all of their child basic needs are being met while in foster care. So a volunteer is essential. They make a monumental difference in a child's life. And there are only three juvenile justices. So the court system need a volunteer to make sure that that child is okay while in foster care.
So that's interesting, because I think when people hear court-appointed special advocate, they think it has only to do with legal proceedings. But in fact, this child's been taken out of the home, put in foster care. Somebody has to keep an eye on that child and make sure that they're getting what they need in foster care and everywhere else, doing what they're supposed to be doing in school. And that's what a CASA volunteer does?
That's right. That's what a volunteer does. A volunteer makes sure that all of that child's basic needs are being met while in foster care. When you finish the class, it's a 7-chapter class. It's here at our office in the evening time from 5 to 5:30 to 8. You're supervised. You're assigned to an advocate coordinator. The myth is you walk this by yourself. You do not walk this by yourself. There's coaching sessions with your advocate coordinator to make sure whatever problems you're having, they work it out. Our executive director, Wendy McGee, she's there with the volunteers. She's there with the advocate coordinators. She's there to help us do what we need to do to make sure that children are properly cared for and the volunteer doesn't get stressed out, because it can get stressful. So you have two people that's there for you. You have the advocate coordinator and the executive director that walks with you, and the other people that are there with our volunteers are the court judges. The judges really, really appreciate everyone who volunteers to help with our children. I got 30-plus children on the list. I need your help now.
I got a text that comes in here from somebody saying that sounds like more of a job for a social worker. What would you say to that?
It's not a job for a social worker. It's a job for somebody. See, my thing is, somebody made a difference in your life. Why can't you make a difference in one of these children's lives? That's our children. You're substantial in what you do. You learn how to help a child to feel good about themselves and be better children for adults, for the society. And I need you, because like I said, everybody that has prominence, somebody through your lifetime made a difference in your life, or you wouldn't be where you are today. You're a radio announcer. Guess what? Somewhere down the line, somebody said to you, don't go that direction. Let me show you which way to go. And it made you a better person for the society and a better man because somebody cares.
Margaret,
and that's all I'm asking. Somebody to step up and say.
Let me tell you one thing I often say. I think the biggest myth that people tell themselves is that they're self-made people. None of us are self-made. We all got a break
here. No, we're
here,
not.
A break there.
No,
we got guidance there. Guidance there.
Yes.
Something to defer, to get you off of the bad road and get you on the right road that we just kind of ignore and tend to give all the credit to ourselves. What kind of time commitment are you overall? Are you like committing to for say one child, or how many children are you going to have? Just one? If you're
one advocate, one child. It's the commitment is completing a case. All we're asking is that when you start with this child, I know situation happens and things happen in your life. If you're going to start with this child, fight it through. Be there with that child so that child will have your support, knowing that you're there for them. I ask that you finish the case. On the application, it says 2 years. Cases normally don't last past 2 years, but it's always that possibility. As I said before, you don't put children in your car. You don't bring them to your house. You don't take care of them. You don't even use your money. We need your eyes, ears, and voice for this child to make a difference in this child's life. CASA Jefferson, www.casajefferson.org. Our number is 504-533-8757. I'm Margaret Ether, the advocate recruiter. Come on, y'all, help us out. We need y'all.
And you said now, you have to be at least 21, but is there an upper age limit or not?
No. I have a lady that's 69, almost 70, that's going to be in the next class. She's viable. She still drives. We need people to just want to make a difference and help us with our children. But you got to be 21 years of age to start off with.
I was just going to say, you're asking, Margaret, is for people, if you do think that this is for you, if you do think that you can stick with it, at least take the training, correct?
Yes, finish the training. I know this is not for everybody. I know that. If you want to make a donation, that's fine. But we need bodies to help with bodies, especially our children. We watch TV, we see all this stuff going on, and look inside yourself. Examine yourself. What is my purpose in life? How do I help? We have a lot of people volunteer at a lot of places, but you're dealing with lives, and we have to make a difference in our children's lives. We really do.
Thank you, Margaret. Contact information one more time before we let you go.
504-533-8757 is the number here at the office, www.costajefferson.org. Go online, look us up, read about us, but I need your help. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you. You'll make a difference in the world. That'd be a good word to make a first step. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Judy Ho, our friend, Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. I'd like to hear from you on the Oakmanard Jeweler talk and text line, 504-260-1870. Please do not ever text and drive. If you're a grown-up child, how's your relationship with your parents, who I presume are grown-up because that's normally the way it works? Or if you're a parent, how's your relationship with your grown-up child? I think I said that the other way around, yeah. And also, when it comes to raising your kids, are you doing it the way your parents did, if your children are, in fact, children, or are you doing it your own way? We'll talk about all that when we come back on WWL. It is 9:26 now on this Tuesday morning. Every other Tuesday, we're concerned with mental health every day, but every other Tuesday, we talk to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books. Today, we're going to talk about parenting between ways to discipline your kids. What did your parents do? We'll also talk about an email I received from somebody about a relationship with an adult child, and I asked y'all to text in about your relationship if you are a parent with your grown child or a grown child with your parent. Somebody texted in and said, I talk to my son every day. He either calls me or I call him. We have a wonderful relationship. I love his wife like my own daughter. We get together just about every week. I love him. Good for them. Congratulations. Sometimes it doesn't work out that well. Good morning, Dr. Judy. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. How are you today?
I am okay. The email I got was from somebody that said they got a, and this is sad, I'm not laughing about it, but it's just that they got a text for their Father's Day gift. They got a letter from their adult child telling them what a terrible father they'd been throughout their life.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
An 8-page letter, and they don't know how to deal with that. And they found it particularly tough coming on Father's Day. And I'm not laughing at the fact that it was on Father's Day, but I'm just thinking, wow, well, that's a touch right there that you don't think of often on Father's Day. But anyway, go ahead. Talk about that.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, to me, it sounds like, without knowing more about the situation, that this adult child probably has been holding resentment every single Father's Day, not actually wanting to celebrate, thinking how terrible the father was. And of course, it's all perception, right? I mean, I understand that everyone's reality might be different, and it sounds like this father is pretty surprised. So who knows? But, you know, no matter what the case is, it kind of feels like he wanted to hit him in the jugular with this news. Like, hey, for this Father's Day, I'm going to tell you exactly what a terrible father you've been and why I've resented celebrating you every single year on this day. I mean, that's sad. I don't know how that's supposed to start off a pathway for healing when it's done on such a day that can be especially hurtful. But I don't know. Maybe it can help open conversation. I get it. You know, sometimes as adults, we think back to our childhood or certain times, and maybe we start to have different ideas about what it was like. And you know, we're entitled to that, but also we all only have so much time. So maybe try to use it wisely. And if you do want to have a relationship with your father, and that's why you wrote this letter, maybe extend an olive branch another way.
And I'm no Judy Ho, and I'm not laughing at this at all because it's tragic. The only thing that made me kind of smirk was that this is not a coincidence. This can't be this.
Of course not.
Whoever wrote that letter can't think that, oh, wait, oh, by the way, it's Father's Day as well. This had to have been done intentionally, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what I mean by like really wanting to hurt him, you know. And so I don't know if the purpose was just to get something off your chest. Fine. But if your purpose is actually to say, hey, I want change in our relationship, I want us to have a better relationship, and that's why I'm writing this letter, then that probably wasn't the best move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what are some of the keys before we get to adults and young children? What are some of the keys to grown parents? Well, obviously, the parents are grown, you would hope, having successful relationships with grown children and grown children having successful relationships with their parents?
I guess I would say that it's important to know that every stage of your child's life, and now adult child, it's going to change your relationship as well. I think that sometimes in parental roles, probably people get a little locked into, well, this is how it is, or, well, you're supposed to listen to what I say because obviously I'm your mom. But it kind of feels like sometimes when people don't open their minds to, oh, maybe this is a different phase and they need me in a different way, or we're going to interact in a different way, it causes grief for everybody. So what I mean by that is, obviously in early adulthood, many adult children are going to drift a little bit from their family, not in a bad way, but, you know, they're just out there discovering their life. Maybe they're going to college, starting their first job, and they're just doing more things on their own. They're not calling as much. They're not visiting as much. And I feel like that's usually a pain point for a lot of parents, like, oh my gosh, you know, my kid doesn't even care about me or want me anymore. But I think if you did your job right, that's what they're supposed to do.
So when it comes to the dynamic of, and somebody texted this in, which is, I wish I could take it as my own, but it's not. Basically, they're saying that they try to go back to when their child was young, but they're not the same people that they were when their child was young, and their child is certainly not the same person when their child was young, so that there is this constant right. evolution that goes on, right?
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's a constant evolution, not only to parenting, but obviously to life, to your own management of your life, your friendships, your hobbies, how much time you're spending doing certain things like working or when you retire. So I feel like that's a constant, but maybe for some people, when you're looking at your children, they're also serving, obviously you're there to help them thrive and grow, but also maybe they're serving as a type of security for you and a type of coping for you. And so of course you're going to have certain feelings when you feel like your role is changing and that maybe they don't need you as much, or maybe right now they're going through a period where they're just rebelling against you, whether as an adult or as a teen. But that doesn't mean that it's not going to come back around and evolve again. You know, it's never permanent. That's kind of what I think. And I've heard lots of people I've worked with, my friends, colleagues, et cetera, never going to talk to my mom again or my dad again. And it's like, yeah, well, you're not talking to them right now, but you might decide you want to a few months down the line. And you know what? Most of the times people do, like, they get estranged maybe for some reason, and then they bring it back together again. And sometimes it's better that they had that moment apart and their relationship is stronger now.
Somebody texted in and said, my grown child texts me every couple of weeks to see how I'm doing, and I don't want to always be the bearer of bad news because I'm not doing very well, but then I don't want to lie to them either. So how do you settle that?
Well, I understand that. And sometimes it might even feel embarrassing to say you're not doing well, or you don't want to put that burden on your children, and that's very heroic. However, I think your child is texting or calling, checking in because they really want to, and they actually want to hear what's going on. You know how sometimes you're like walking down the hall and somebody says, hey, how are you? And you know that they really don't want to hear it. They're just saying that. And you're supposed to just say, fine, and you just like move on. But I think there's other moments where people really want to hear what's going on in your life, and they don't want to just hear like, yeah, everything's fine, everything's great. So I think it's okay to maybe open up just a little bit. You don't have to, you know, let the floodgates in or anything, but you can just open up and say a little bit of like, hey, you know what? I'm kind of struggling right now to tell you the truth, but I'm glad you called. And I'm not really wanting to talk about the details right now, but I just want to let you know that, you know, I'm not doing the best, but I always love hearing from you. I think that would mean a lot to your child, just to know that you're being honest with them.
All right. Somebody else texted in and said they're a parent. They don't know how involved to get with their child's life, who is in the 30s. And apparently it's a long text with something about buying a house and renting or something. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think that you would hope that as, you know, that your kids are still coming to you for advice. But I think that as they get older, they're probably going to want to start to do some things on their own and have their own decisions. And I think that's okay. I really think that's okay. So I think you can offer to help. Like, do you want my opinion? Do you want my advice? If you don't, fine.
But if you do, great, I'm here. I'm happy to roll up my sleeves and help you. I think that the best thing that parents can do is just offer the support. And then if your kids want it, they'll let you know for sure. They will.
All right, let me take a break. 9:34, 26 till 10, talking to our friend Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast about parent and grown child relationships. We'll also talk about parent and child relationships when we come back. 504-260-187. If you have any questions or comments, that's the Oakwinar Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Please do not dare ever text and drive. Back in a flash, WWL traffic now, I think, right? All right, 9:41, 19 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast, author of several books. Dr. Judy, I lied. I said one text popped up that I couldn't wait to tell you. There are actually two of them that popped up. But first things first, somebody texted in and said, how do we tell our parents that we don't want kids?
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah, I know. People oftentimes there's sort of like a trajectory that we think our kids are going to take, and maybe they take a different one, and all of a sudden you have to regroup and manage that. And so I'm guessing that this listener has already gotten some pressure from their parents, so they kind of know that that's where they're hoping for them to go. I think that it's not going to be one conversation. I think it's really just introducing that idea, saying that this is what you've decided with your spouse or your partner, and basically acknowledging that maybe they have some feelings, maybe they might be disappointed about this, but that you guys are sure, you guys have thought a lot about it, and this is your decision. I mean, I think that sometimes parents might try to convince them, oh, you don't know, like having kids is so amazing, how do you blah, 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 blah. But, you know, if you've already made up your mind and you're pretty sure about it, doesn't mean you can't change your mind later, but this is not really on the table. I think it is important to tell them that directly, but expect that it's going to keep coming up. You know, expect that they might ask you a question again or say, well, have you changed your mind? And I think it's just about being firm with them and realizing where it comes from, that it's usually from a place of good intention as opposed to them just trying to annoy you and pester you and try to fix you into a life that you don't want for yourself.
Well, you know what? I'm going to put off the other text because a third one popped up just now and says, those people are lucky. We're trying to decide whether or not we want kids. So I don't know how, from a clinical psychologist, neuropsychologist standpoint, you approach that, because people that have kids, how can I phrase this? How do I tell people this all the time? People that don't have kids miss a lot. People that don't have kids miss a lot. So you can look at it negatively or positively, right? So how do people go about discerning whether or not they want to be parents or could be parents from the, I know they got a religious standpoint to this, they got a spiritual standpoint to this, but from the neuropsychologist standpoint, what would you tell somebody?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think that for everybody, it's different. I mean, some people will, if they feel like the methodical type, they might want to sit down and write a pros and cons list. If they're spiritual, they might want to pray about it. It's obviously a big decision, so it's great that they're really contemplating it seriously as opposed to just doing anything on a whim. But I also think that, you know,
yes, a whim is never good. A whim is never good, especially when it comes to kids.
Not with children.
No, not a whim. No,
but
no,
I feel like
buying a car is not good on a whim. Buying a car is not good on a whim. Getting a puppy is not good on a whim. Why in the hell would you have a kid on a whim? Go ahead, Dr. Judy.
Certainly not. Yeah, or not as a way to try to fix your relationship,
no.
Or to try to like fix a hole in your life somehow. Or like, hey, I don't have a great hobby right now. I might have a time for a kid then. So I think it does take time to like deeply explore what you think you want your life to be about and what, you know, why you're really having a child. I mean, for the longest time, I didn't really think I wanted to have a child, Tommy. Like, I either wasn't sure or I didn't feel like I wanted or needed to. And then it was kind of a gradual process for me of discernment. It didn't happen overnight, but I just started to feel like, oh, I would really like to try. I mean, it doesn't mean that you're going to have one just because you decided to have one, but I was like, I'd like to try to have one. But that took a long time. Mm-hmm. That took a long time, and it kind of went back and forth a little bit. So And now, of course, I can't imagine my life without Luca. Like, I'm so glad that I finally came around to this decision. But everybody's decision is different. I have also friends who discerned for a long time and now they don't have children and they're very happy with that decision. So I think be gentle with yourself, really explore the true reasons why you're having your child, and just make sure that you're not doing it to fix something or to fill a hole in your life that you think otherwise wouldn't be there if you were to have children.
Somebody texted in and said they don't approve of the way their married kids are running their lives financially. They don't want to get involved, but they're terrified that they're going to have to bail the kids out if they get in trouble, and that's going to affect what they've worked so hard to achieve. Thoughts on that, Dr. Judy?
Yeah, it's so hard because obviously your kids are going to make their own decisions, and sometimes they might mess things up or take things out of your plan. All you can do is try your best to educate them, to give them perspective, to let them know that you're available for guidance, and not necessarily to completely rescue them or to take over, because they're not going to allow you to do that anyway, especially as they get older. But I think it's just important to still stay connected. You know, sometimes I think people go through phases where they're just like, well, okay, fine, they don't need me, they don't want to talk to me. But then there's all this resentment about the bad decisions they're making. It's like, well, as a parent, you're always going to be a parent, even when they're an adult. So it is still, I believe that the onus is more so on the parent when they think that their child, their adult child, might be making some bad decisions or going awry, that just check in with them and say, hey, let's get together. And it's not just about like lecturing their ear off, but it's more like, hey, I see this is going on and I just wanted to offer my perspective, you know, take it or leave it, but I wanted to make sure I communicated it. I think that that's important.
Yeah, I can identify with that in a way, because you're concerned with your adult child, and mine's, you know, not in any kind of financial trouble or anything like that, but you do know that you're going to be there to bail them out, whether it's any type of problem that they get into, and you are working hard to take care of yourself and hopefully leave them something. So you do want to get involved to keep from making the big mistake, but yet they got to live their lives as well, right?
Exactly. And I think that you have to trust that you've laid the groundwork that, you know, if they do make a mistake, one, that they will hopefully eventually bounce back, and two, they'll know where to go to for help, that they'll come back to you and say, hey, kind of screwed up here. Mm-hmm. And it's not about them coming back just to ask for money or just to, you know, but it's more just about the fact that they know that you're still there, that they can lean on you. And that they can be honest with you, because it's very shameful too, right? To have to go back to your parents and say, oh man, like I really messed up and now I might need to borrow money, et cetera. But at the same time, if they feel comfortable coming to you, you know, within limits, it's not about just giving them all your money, but it's more like, okay, well, now we can have a conversation. Now we can have a dialogue about it. So there's always teaching moments that are available, and hopefully the next time around, they'll make a better decision.
Somebody texted and said they feel they were too soft on their adult children. Because now, they were too soft on their adult children, because mm-hmm. now the child seems to need help with everything and has a hard time standing on their own, and they're wondering about weaning off of cell phone and cable and paying these bills and those bills and the other bills.
Yeah, it's hard. I think that we want to protect our kids from pain. But there's a point where maybe they're kind of taking advantage, even subconsciously, and they are being too dependent. And maybe you're thinking, oh, man, I wish I taught them this a little earlier, and now we're kind of set a precedence. But you can always change. It's just that they're going to fight it probably a little bit. They're going to not be used to it when all of a sudden you're not paying all of these different bills. And you can do it gradually, but you have to be firm about it, because ultimately that's the most important thing. Like, you're not going to be around forever. You want them to have these adult skills that they then pass on to their children, right? And to the next generation or to whoever they're in relationship with. And so I think sometimes it can be quite painful in the beginning when you're trying to assert new boundaries, especially after a long period of being maybe more lenient. But at the end of the day, it's much better for their development.
Somebody texted this in. We're getting some good texts today. This one says, I understand that, but my child is only going to be 30 once, and I don't want them to have to struggle like I did. But I think, Dr. Judy, and this is just me saying this, you can say what you want, but I think there's something to be said for going through the struggle, right? Maybe?
Well, I agree with you, and I understand that feeling too. And I think that that's part of what produces children who become more dependent on their parents, not on purpose, because it's a loving thing. You don't want your kids to struggle. So you're like, let me provide for them. But then they do become ultra dependent, and they can't stand on their own two feet as much. And so there has to be somewhat of a balance. I hear this more and more, actually, with this generation, because the previous generation did go through some pretty hard times, and now their child, they don't want their child to suffer, but then their child can't, you know, pay the bills, can't keep a bank account, can't hold a job, because they know that security is always going to be there. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the balance is sort of like, yeah, of course, like, pursue what you want. Like, you have the ability to do that now. Like, we have to just take whatever job we got. Like, you have the possibility to follow your dream. However, you still have to be disciplined about it, and you have to stick with something, even if it doesn't feel great for the first few months, because it doesn't always feel great. It's still called a job, you know? So I think it's those types of things where you have to find that balance. And it's like, well, what is struggle really? And also, struggle builds resilience, right? And you want them to have those resiliency skills, because we're all going to struggle. We're all going to stress. That's just part of the human experience. You can't shield your kid from every single one of those stressors. You can only teach them how to cope when stressors come up.
You know, I always tell people, and I'm not ancient or anything, but I tell people that are in their 20s, it's like, it's a balance when it comes to bucket list items and those kind of things, because life is a struggle. And by the time you get yourself established, sometimes you might be too old to do those bucket list items, or too established in a job to take off and go do whatever it is you wanted to do. But I would think that's something that is not just this generation. I would think that's something that generations have been going through forever almost, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like history clearly always repeats itself. And so it's like, okay, you're going to struggle, then you're not going to struggle. There's going to be a period where things are relatively easier, then you're going to struggle again. And the struggles can be different each time. It might be a financial struggle, then a relationship struggle, then an identity struggle. I mean, it's just part of living. But at the same time, you're also maybe, this is a perspective, you're maybe taking away that great feeling from your child if they are able to overcome something mostly on their own. I mean, I know that when I've struggled and I've overcome it, it means a lot more if I feel like I had something to do with overcoming it. Doesn't mean that I did it all by myself, but it's more like, oh, something I did made the situation better. And that's that kind of confidence only comes from experience.
Yeah, because you know you'll be able to do it next time. Thank you, Dr. Judy. Appreciate it as always. Dr. Judy Ho, clinical forensic neuropsychologist, host of the Supercharged Life podcast. Couple of quick texts, Doc hit a chord. My 36-year-old single mom daughter tells me I lecture her too much. Somebody else said, is this somewhat of a poor man's subject? I feel like rich people can give their children money for life and no one thinks about it. Somebody else texted and said, give enough to do something, but not enough to do nothing. We'll find out what Noel's got planned for us when we come back here on WWL.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses like Rise Bakery connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.